Even if you don't watch the TV show Yellowstone, there's a good chance you know people who do. The very popular Western is entering its fifth season. It's already got multiple spinoffs planned, and it's not slowing down. Kevin Costner plays the patriarch of the Dutton family, and their story and sprawling ranch are one of television's biggest current success stories. I'm Linda Holmes, and today we're talking about Yellowstone on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Joining us today is New York Times columnist and University of North Carolina Chapel Hill professor, Tressie McMillan Cottom. Welcome, Tressie.
Hello, hello, hello. It's a thrill to be here.
Well, it's a thrill to have you here to talk about Yellowstone. For people who are not familiar, Yellowstone stars Kevin Costner as John Dutton, the super mega rich patriarch of the super mega rich Dutton family. John rules over the Yellowstone Ranch with the brutality of Tony Soprano, but he is also given to frequent musings about what really matters and how life ought to be. He is aided by his equally merciless daughter, Beth, played by Kelly Riley, and his son, Casey, played by Luke Grimes, who used to be a Navy SEAL. His son, Jamie, played by Wes Bentley, is a lawyer who is kind of the black sheep of the family because he wears a suit instead of a cowboy hat. The Duttons are constantly knocking heads, not only with a series of evil developers who are very similar to each other, but also with the leadership of the nearby Broken Rock Reservation. The reservation's leader, Thomas Rainwater, played by Gil Birmingham, is sometimes an ally and sometimes an obstacle for John as John maneuvers in politics and business to make sure he keeps total control of the land he believes his family should possess forever. Yellowstone was created by Taylor Sheridan and John Linson. You might be familiar with Sheridan from his screenplays for the films Hell or High Water and Sicario. Yellowstone airs on the Paramount Network. It's streaming on Peacock, but its prequel, 1883, streams on Paramount Plus, and there are two additional shows on the way. In short, this thing is big business, and I am so glad we are diving in. Tressie, you watched all four previous seasons of Yellowstone. Why did you do that?
That is an excellent question that I should probably take up with a professional therapist. So my motivation here was that we don't tend to take our pop culture seriously. And of course, I don't include you, because one of the things I love about this show is that you take it quite seriously. But I was hearing about this show from very different corners of my own personal world. This show was clearly very popular among many people in my family, friends of friends, or just as I was like, you know, going about my daily life. But it was not popular. It was like it almost didn't exist in my pop culture obsessed professional world. Twitter, other social media, academics, writers, journalists.
We've never covered it before today.
Right. This was the biggest show in the country, and people whose job it was to pay attention to big cultural movements were by and large not talking about it.
Yeah.
That will always interest me. When something can be happening in plain sight that we've all just sort of tacitly agreed to pass by, that means something over there is happening. And I'm a bit like a cultural fire person. I run towards that fire.
Right.
Underneath of that, of course, was politics, which is what one, I think, should always expect. Our aesthetics are driven by our politics. And I was interested in what kind of politics were so aesthetically powerful for a large part of this country, but was invisible to another part of this country.
Yeah. What did you find? I mean, what did you find in terms of that question?
Yeah, in terms of that question, because I think I found a lot of things. I found that soap operas continue to be very popular because this is fundamentally a soap opera.
Yep.
If you grew up with grandparents or whatever watching Days of Our Lives or Dallas, you know what this show is. But as far as our aesthetics and our politics, what was interesting to me was a craving for a version of conservatism that would allow people to feel good about themselves. Mm-hmm. That's actually what I came away from this show with, which is this desire to have like small C conservatism that did not adhere to either political ideology. This is a show for apolitical political people.
Yeah.
Who don't want to think about big P politics. The show is very heavy-handed about making sure the characters hate Democrats and Republicans alike.
The only people everybody hates, I think, are people from California.
Oh, California is the stand-in for everything wrong with society. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. The Californian is the super villain throughout the show. I say the exact same thing. They really hate California in the show. I don't know who in California hurt Taylor Sheridan, but it really comes through like an ex-girlfriend in the script.
It really does.
But this is a show for people who wanted to say, yes, we're conservative, but we can allow some nominal diversity. This is, casting-wise, a notably diverse show. There are Black cowboys. There is a full Native American world, not just Native American characters. And I think there's a difference. You see Native Americans' home life, their own political machinations. That's not very common in mm-hmm. our popular culture. It's a conservative audience that does not think about big politics, but certainly has their political leanings. And they're like, listen, we can allow some diversity. We are not the boogeyman that we're made out to be in the press, right?
Sure.
We love all people as long as they're trying to be like us. And that's their accommodation of diversity. There's some accommodation of feminism. Mm-hmm. The most psychotic character in the entire show is a woman.
That is accurate. That is accurate.
And I think that is a sort of like conservative adoption of feminism.
Right.
Saying like, no, we don't have a problem with women. Women are strong and amazing. And in fact, they can be as big a serial killer as anybody else, sort of thing.
I feel like it doesn't get enough attention that this whole family is serial murderers. Just giant, relentless serial murderers.
Yes, over and over again. It's the way they bond with one another.
Well, and it's kind of it feels to me like it's the answer to every story question that comes up on the show. It's like, how do we bring these two people together? Murder.
Yep.
How do we drive these people apart? Murder.
That's right.
How do we, create momentum toward the next season and shift sort of who's responsible for things? Murder.
That's right.
They have a literal pit of dead bodies. And they just take people out there and throw them into the pit of dead bodies.
And what I love is how literal the show is. Like, we're not being metaphorical. They push them over a cliff.
Yeah, you just drive them out there and you push them into the pit. The other thing that really struck me when I was watching this show was, it's not a huge, I think, stretch to say that any cowboy show is going to inherently be interrogating masculinity in certain ways. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that this show really made me think about was it has these kind of dual fantasies, right? And this is sort of one of the things that you also talked about in the piece that you wrote for the New York Times. But it has one fantasy of total and absolute control, where everybody can be bent to your will no matter what. But it also has this fantasy where men who beat you, burn you, berate you, tell you you're worthless, do it because they care about you. I wonder if there aren't people for whom that's a potent fantasy, you know?
Absolutely.
The training up of other men comes entirely in the form of literal physical abuse.
Oh, yeah.
But it's all because they care about you. And it's all because they love you and they don't want you to be weak.
It is the classic strong man, homosocial fantasy, I think, of wanting an authoritarian father whose punishment is about love. You can see why that would feel very comforting for people who mostly inherit their small c conservatism from secular religion. It is the loving father of the Old Testament, mm-hmm. not of the New Testament.
That's
Dutton
right.
is Old Testament.
Dutton is Old Testament God.
That's right. He doesn't trust judges. He doesn't trust the law. He doesn't even trust his own family. I do think there is something about the lack of sort of popular religious tropes that allow people to explore their need for that sort of authoritarian figure, and it coming in this really soapy product that makes that feel safe. One of the things I found fascinating after this piece was published is I heard from a lot of fans of the show who said, I'm not conservative. I voted for Obama and I love this show. What are you saying? I'm watching a conservative program. The way they felt so deeply convicted and I think seen that made them really uncomfortable with my argument was that it was a conservative show that they hadn't realized they were consuming because it was conservative. Mm-hmm. that the type of conservatism that is, that wanting, yeah, a father who will punish you, a father who will, I think, help you work out your conflict and your guilt. The thing that Dutton provides in the script, and I think for some audiences, and the role that murder plays, is that it always ends. You're never left suspended in conflict. There's no liminal space. Either you get along with the program or you die.
Yeah.
And I think for some people that is deeply psychologically comforting.
Yeah.
Even if it is very violent.
Well, you know, it's so interesting when you talk about it being soapy, which was my exact reaction to it. My reaction was like, people compare it all the time to Succession. I think that's totally wrong. Succession is a black comedy.
I don't think so. Thank you. I so agree with you.
Succession is a dark comedy. It yes. has very like odd duck people in it who mm-hmm. say things that you would not expect.
Yeah.
Whereas this show to me is a very, very traditional soap opera.
Yes.
Where for the most part, the dialogue is whatever is the most obvious thing for the person to say in the mm-hmm. moment, not for a real person mm-hmm. to say, but the most obvious thing for a character in a soap opera
that
to say.
Right.
There is an actual moment in this show where someone has been shot and someone else says, "Don't you die on me, not like this." And I was like, okay, this is not Succession, Breaking Bad. No. It's not a sort of a show with kind of textured dialogue and stuff like that.
No.
This is something that the writer Catherine Van Arendonk has written about also, is that they forget everything as soon as it happens. And that is sort of a hallmark of soaps. In the pilot of this show, there is a gunfight, which is caused by John Dutton sending his private police force into a battle with some of the guys from the reservation. It results in John's son, Lee, being shot by the guy who is the brother of Casey's wife, his son Casey's wife. In revenge for the killing of Lee, Casey kills his wife Monica's brother. So you have these two deaths. And my thought at the time was, okay, so this whole season is going to be about this family kind of recovering from the profound guilt of John having caused all this, the pain of this loss in the family.
Absolutely not.
That is not what happened at all. There's some, you know, there's a lot of maneuvering around making sure Casey doesn't get in trouble for killing the brother. But other than that, they move on very quickly from that. And that tends to be, I think, the shape of this show. And that's one of the things that I think distinguishes a soap, because obviously what's a soap and what's a drama can be deeply classed and gendered and all that stuff. But in this case, I think because they tend to kind of wipe the slate clean and reset, which of course in the days of soap operas where almost nobody ever saw every single day, you sort of had to do that, reset fairly frequently. It's soapy in that way. Right?
Yeah. No, this is a soap opera for men and the women who want proximity to those men. I think you're exactly spot on in that it does not learn its lesson, which is a hallmark of soap operas that became obviously as a structural solution, as you said, to the advertising problem that people couldn't sit in front of the TV. We weren't designed to stream it, which is how I have watched it and consumed it. We certainly weren't designed to binge it because that actually makes you, as an audience member, unless you turn off a significant part of your brain, it makes you feel insane. There is no continuity of a moral arc across the show. And so by the end, you've just been in a cycle of violence and very boring sex over and over and over again. But if you watch it, I think as designed episodically, it makes a little bit more sense. So yes, it is a soap opera in that sense. It is also a soap opera in another sense, which you also hit on, why it's different from Succession. There is no humor. Mm-hmm. There's not a single joke or punchline in the show. And I mean, this was something I was quite deliberately looking for, because humor is one of those lines of demarcation between genre types.
Right. Oh, right? For sure.
So yes, Succession is different because it is satirical, but because it has any humor at all. That is one of the hallmarks of making it prestige television. So playing with irony and subtext is usually how we think of the difference between genres. And so there's no humor in the show. It does not trust the audience at all to close any of its own inconsistencies. That's the very literal talking points from the actors. That's the very literal interpretation of metaphors, physically throwing people over the cliff. What I find interesting about it is that it looks, however, very much like prestige television. So I think one of the things that Sharon has been very good at in this show, and why I suggested that liberal audiences should give it a go. I'm not saying you should watch it all, and you certainly should not binge it.
Mm-mm, don't binge it.
I strongly recommend that you don't binge it. But there was something interesting to how he has lifted and elevated the visual symbols of being prestige television without doing any of the work of the genre. There's no moral arc. There's no anti-hero. There is no continuity. There's no subtext. There's no metaphor. But it is beautiful. It has all of the money and everything that comes with that stunning scenery. Extremely high level casting, which we've talked about off mic.
Yeah,
they're punching way above their weight class in casting,
especially as the spinoffs go on.
Yeah,
and you have this one with Helen Mirren and Harrison Ford. That's wild.
Helen Mirren, like, are you kidding me? And I think that that is also about where conservative audiences are today, which is the fare that they typically get is low budget because there isn't a lot of competition for them as an audience. And so the fact that they get this really prestige looking genre that operates like a soap opera is, I think, Taylor Sheridan's genius. He's nailed that.
What do you like? Who do you think is interesting on this show?
Oh, the people that they're never going to completely write for, which is unfortunate to my mind. So they have it's going to sound like it's obvious, like, oh, yeah, of course, you know, the Black woman sociologist wants the Black cowboy to do more. But the lines they have given him suggest that there is somebody who's writing for him on that script who thinks he could do more. Like he tosses off these lines about being at home, but it means something different when you hear that from a Black cowboy who's living on an estate owned by basically a white oligarch who uses convict labor to make the whole system go. Having a Black cowboy in that mix complicates all the binaries, right? Speaking of which, hello, there's a whole subplot about convict labor.
There is.
That, like, nobody is going, that is extremely messed up. So a huge underworld of the Dutton Ranch as empire is that his trusted field hand / assassin picks up a recently released convict, formerly imprisoned people, and says, listen, if you want to be free, meaning the Dutton Ranch will give you its political power.
Right.
Will give you a job for life. You come work on the ranch. You can never move up. This is not a job in the sense that you're going to work yourself into a new life. You actually come there and you become imprisoned by the ranch. You get owned. And how do they make that concrete for the audience? Because again, everything's literal. They brand them like cattle.
They sort of do stuff like that and then they don't go into it at all.
Right.
There's kind of no interest in it. It's the same thing as, like I said, I sort of thought they were going to spend a lot of time in that first season talking about how it was John's insistence on riding in with his private police force that led to that whole situation. Not at all.
Like,
the fact that he has essentially taken over, he and then later Casey, have essentially taken over local law enforcement to a great degree.
Mm-hmm.
They're not interested in the story of why that might be bad at all. Mm-hmm. They just go along. Eventually, John runs for governor. And you know that, like, if he's governor, he's going to be foundationally corrupt, which he doesn't even really hide. The purpose of becoming governor is to protect his private property, which kind of no one seems to mind, which I find odd. But
kind of odd and very unlikely, yes.
And this is all, again, I think an element of its soapiness is how much of the setting you have to pretend you don't know about, because there are these moments where people have meetings where a high-level, super expensive property deal will be far, 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 far along. And all of a sudden somebody will say, aha, but what about the Endangered Species Act? And it's like, no, no, no. People who make this kind of money, they would have done that ages ago. That's not going to come up in the last meeting where somebody is like, dun, da, da, da. That is not where you're going to hear about the Endangered Species Act or zoning or whatever. That is not going to come up that way. That's going to come up way, way, way before that.
Yeah. And everybody, all of the political actors by that point have been bought and paid for. The idea that John Dutton is the most powerful political actor in all of Yellowstone, but he doesn't know about a major development deal until weeks before it happens, subverts actually the very idea of how powerful he is.
Right.
Why does he have to resort to guns? Why does he need his own private police force? Time after time, he seems to be clueless and powerless.
Well, because I think they're trying to always set up a situation where he's the imperiled one rather than the one imperiling everyone else.
Yeah.
So they're always trying to say he's just defending his way of life. He's just defending his family.
Yeah.
And you can't really say that about somebody who you acknowledge has so much money that he would probably not need to do this kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, like, who would get their hands dirty like this if they had this kind of money?
Exactly. Guns are for people who are coming for the king. They aren't for the king.
Well, right.
The king doesn't shoot.
Eventually, people would start noticing how many people disappear around this guy and this fam. This is not attention mm-hmm. that an actual person with power wants. But again, it's this fantasy of absolute power where yeah. you're constantly able to just say to people, you're going to do what I say, and if you don't, I'm going to kill you.
Right.
Which is not as satisfying as you're going to do what I say, and if you don't, I'm going to get you fired from your job.
You know, I think the show, in trying to present John Dutton as both a billionaire and imperiled, really pointed to me with one of the inherent tensions of, like, conservatism, which is really hard to make a billionaire cowboy. So the aspects of being a cowboy are exactly that. That yes, you are alone,
mm-hmm.
a loner by choice, so outside of society, right? And your otherness is part of what gives you your sort of superhero powers, because you are not beholden to any political regime or any economic system. You live off of the land. The power was derived from being othered and cast out of a system. But a billionaire is a function of a system that is functioning at a very high level for that person.
Right.
It's really hard to then see a cowboy in a billionaire, which is why there are all these jokes among people. You know, I have a lot of friends from, like, Nashville and Tennessee and, like, country Americana world. It's a joke about the guys with the pressed jeans and the really fancy boots and, you know, all hat and no cattle sort of thing, even though there's a lot of money in that part of the world. But nobody sees that as an actual cowboy. The way this show is trying to merge those two genres, because the cowboy genre is very popular when empires are in their twilight, and arguably that's where we are. They needed that trope, but then they had to put it in a billionaire package because that's our celebrity these days. The
right.
billionaires are our celebrities. They're the
right.
Kardashians, right? But when you mash those two up, you do get these really weird inconsistencies. Like, how is the most powerful person in the world always so vulnerable? How does everybody touch him?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is the tension of trying to mash up the genres. And then again, making it soapy.
Yeah, it's really... I tend not to buy into the arguments that the reason it hasn't been nominated for, like, a boatload of Emmys is its conservatism. I think the reason it hasn't been nominated for a boatload of Emmys is that it's a soap, and it's harder to get soaps nominated than it used to be, right?
Yes.
It used to be, like, Dynasty got nominated for Emmys, but that was a very different television world. I don't necessarily buy that it deserves to get nominated for Emmys, but I am, and this is going right back to what you said at the very beginning, I am really glad that I watched it and that I read a bunch of stuff about it and that I talked about it with
yeah.
you for exactly the reason that you said, which is that there's always something there when there's something that is kind of grabbing people's attention to this degree.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that the people behind promoting the show play with that conservative label whenever it's convenient, you know.
Right.
If you ask Taylor Sheridan, he says, we're not a conservative show. Where are people getting this from? But then they absolutely play into that narrative with their audience when they don't get the awards. You've spent that much money. Of course you want some awards. Like, let's not be cute about this thing.
Right.
But I do not think it's about being conservative either. I think this is absolutely about the fact that it is a soap opera. And even of the soap opera genre, it's not the best.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm glad we got a chance to talk about it. And we do want to know what you think about Yellowstone. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH. That brings us to the end of our show. Tressie McMillan-Cottom, thank you so much for being here. This was so much fun.
It was a lot of fun. I love nerding out on this with you.
Absolutely, me too. And of course, thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you have a second, sign up for our newsletter. It's at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. This episode was produced by Ramel Wood and Hafsa Fathima and edited by Jessica Reedy. Hello Come In provides our theme music. I'm Linda Holmes, and we'll see you all tomorrow.